The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. Today's interview originally aired in December 2009, but we enjoyed it so much and found it so interesting that we wanted to air it again. Barry Schwartz is the Dorwin Cartwright Professor of Social Theory and Social Action at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. Barry has studied how prosperous societies, where people are offered an abundance of freedom and choice, also seem to be experiencing a greater-than-average incidence of depression. Does having more options actually undermine our happiness? But before we get to Barry, let's hear some speaking up. I'm on the line with Daniel Loxton, editor and illustrator of Junior Skeptic, the wonderful insert found inside every issue of Skeptic magazine. He's also the author of Evolution, How We and All Living Things Came to Be. Thanks for being here, Daniel.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. So, it's funny that it's taken Skeptically Speaking this long to get around to doing a speaking up on this, but what is skepticism?
Well, skepticism is an old word. It's been in use for thousands of years, and it can mean a lot of things, all to do with the idea of doubt or with trying not to take things for granted, or better, an attempt to expose falsehood or try to get at the truth. In the kind of work I do at Skeptic Magazine, skeptic.com, we are part of an intellectual tradition of the 20th century of organized skepticism, which is a kind of science-based attempt to look at fringe claims and try to get to the bottom of them. So we look at a lot of psychics and kind of pseudo-scientific, paranormal-type things, monsters and things that go bump in the night, which is a tradition that goes back through guys like Carl Sagan and Isaac Asimov, and back to characters like Houdini, who some of your listeners may know was, in his day, quite a famous buster of fraudulent psychic mediums.
So now you're talking about capital S, skepticism.
Yeah, some people make those kinds of distinctions. I try not to capitalize skepticism at any time. I just try and explain which of the competing uses I'm employing.
Right. So what would the difference between that be? And I understand you don't use that label, but since a lot of people do, what's sort of the working definition?
Well, there is a kind of a subculture of skeptics now, who are people who pattern themselves in a kind of a science-based way, try and look at the world through an evidence-based kind of a lens. You know, and it's a community now with media that serves them and is generated by them. And so that's the kind of capital S skeptic that people sometimes talk about.
So that doesn't actually sound controversial, but within that community, sometimes it can be. So what's the debate about? One of the things I hear about is this or is this not a social movement?
Well, you know, skepticism is a kind of, it's a subculture of nerds, and nerds like to talk about things and argue about things, and that's one of them. So, you know, you can have a subculture that argues about whether or not it's a subculture. You know, skepticism is a kind of a social movement at this point, which has grown out of this more academic field of inquiry, where, you know, there are scientists and historians and journalists who will try and solve these mysteries in a rigorous academic way. And then there are people who will more passively or in a more of a grassroots or an informal kind of way will support that sort of work or will become fans of that sort of work. And that has grown into a kind of a subculture as people, especially through the internet, have found each other, found their tribe. And you hear this sort of, I thought I was the only one thing quite often. But in the meantime, you know, the more formal academic project keeps rolling along as well.
And that's the one that's focused on testable claims.
Yeah, that's right. Looked at this way, skepticism as a project is really just like a kind of journalism or a kind of science or, you know, a field that borrows from all these related fields of rigorous inquiry. And it's just a matter of, in a rigorous way, trying to get to the bottom of strange or controversial or weird kind of claims.
So how about the other question that I hear a lot, and there's a lot of conversation around it, the idea that skepticism and atheism are or are not, depending on who you're talking to, synonymous?
Well, that's a that's an old chestnut. That's been batted back and forth like a tennis ball for decades. Demographically, it's true. The skeptical community and the atheist community have a tremendous amount of overlap. But there are many skeptics, responsible skeptics, evidence-based, science-based thinkers who are religious. And conversely, there are many atheists who are really pretty much insane. one does not necessarily imply the other, although there are people who will argue that an insistence that we wait for evidence before we grant provisional assent to claims, that will tend to imply atheism. That's that's not the drum I beat, but it is a common argument.
Right. And you just mentioned argument. So there are people who argue about this.
Oh, yes. Fiercely. Nothing gets people so riled up as politics and religion. And, you know, the skeptical community is no exception to that.
So now how does skepticism fit in with political activity?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I work mostly with a nonprofit organization in the United States, which has, you know, there are laws governing the kind of political action that nonprofits in most countries can take. The community of skeptics tends to lean liberal or libertarian for those who are interested in that sort of thing. My position and the kind of default position of most organizations has been that these kinds of value questions, ethical questions, what ought we to do, those are really matters of personal conscience, whereas what we're interested in the skeptical project is just trying to find out what's objectively true. So if you have a testable question that may have an impact on public policy, that's grist for our mill. But if you just simply have an ethical position that you want to advance, skepticism is probably not the place to do it.
So if people wanted to find out more about skepticism as you define it, where would they go?
I would suggest skeptic.com as a first stop, randy.org and psicop.org, C-S-I-C-O-P.org. Those are the three big North American skeptics organizations. There are many significant regional groups and other national groups throughout Canada and around the world as well, but those are among the vanguard.
Now, what about if someone wanted to compare that with somebody else's perspective on it? What's a good example of kind of an opposing position on it?
I don't know. I mean, if you're asking where can people go to find out more about atheism, you might want to check out the Richard Dawkins organization or P.Z. Myers if you want a more of a kind of two-fisted approach to the topic.
So we're sending people off to do research at this point is what we're doing.
I'm sorry. Is that not very helpful?
No. I think that's great. Lovely to have you here, sir.
Thank you very much for having me.
And we'll be right back with more Skeptically Speaking after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call in every Friday from 6 to 7 Mountain Time at 780-492-2577, extension 1. That's 780-492-2577, extension 1. Or head to the Ustream chat room and ask questions of our guests and talk with other listeners. Just click the Listen Online link at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments before or during the show to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, at Skeptical Radio. After the show, continue the conversation on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to the show in iTunes or listen to past episodes. And while you're there, why not add your review? Skeptically Speaking airs live on CJSR 88.5 in Edmonton and is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. Check the media page at skepticallyspeaking.com to see if we air near you. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. And today's interview is with psychologist Barry Schwartz, Dorwin Cartwright Professor of Social Theory and Social Action at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. His research and teaching focus on the intersection of psychology and economics, and more specifically, on the abundance of choice in modern life. He's the author of a veritable plethora of journal articles, as well as books like The Costs of Living, The Battle for Human Nature, and The Paradox of Choice, Why More is Less. So in your writing, Barry, you refer to the dogma of personal choice. Can you explain that?
In most Western societies, and most especially in the U.S., there's a kind of syllogism that we all take for granted that goes roughly like this. that you can't have too much freedom. The more freedom people have, the better off they are. That seems completely uncontroversial. So if you accept that, then the question is, how do you give people the kind of freedom that enhances their well-being? And the answer is you give them choice. Freedom without choice is empty. So if more freedom means you more well-being and more choice means more freedom, then it seems self-evident that if you want to make people better off, if you want to make them happier, the thing to do is to give them more choice. Any domain in life where people have choice is better than a domain in which they don't. And that it seems to me, is the gospel of the industrialized West, and especially the U.S.
But you contend that that's very, very wrong.
Well, here's what's wrong. It is absolutely right that without choice, you can't live a fully human life. So there's no doubt that people need choice. The mistake that we have made as a society, and by the way, psychologists have made this mistake in their research, is to assume that since some choice is good, more choice must be better. And so you compare the amount of choice people have now to the amount of choice people had 20, 30, 40 years ago, and it would seem that we have created paradise on earth. And lo and behold, people are paralyzed instead of liberated. They're tormented. They're dissatisfied with their decisions. They're flocking to shrinks. They're taking antidepressant medications. So we've given people exactly what we think they want, and they are not responding in the way that we would expect them to.
How did you come to this conclusion?
I came to this conclusion myself when I went to replace my jeans. And I buy them at the Gap, which I assume you have in Texas, Canada.
Yes.
So I went to the Gap, and I buy jeans infrequently because I hate to break in new jeans. So I went to the salesperson, and I said, I want a pair of jeans, and this is my size. And the salesperson said, well, you want slim fit, easy fit, relaxed fit, button fly, zipper fly, stone washed, acid washed, boot cut, tapered, on and on and on it went. And I said, I want the kind that used to be the only kind. And A, the clerk was about 12 years old and so had no idea what that was. And B, they didn't make them anymore. So I spent an hour doing what used to take 10 seconds. And the funny thing is, I walked out with the best-fitting pair of jeans I had ever bought, and I felt worse than I ever had before. I did better, and I felt worse. And it occurred to me that this was not a fluke about me, and it wasn't a fluke about buying jeans. It really said something about how when you give people this many options, bad stuff happens to their assessments of even good decisions. So I had that experience, and I filed it away because, as scientists like to say, data is not the plural of anecdote, and because it happened to me doesn't mean it ever happened to anyone else in the world. And then a paper came out, published by somebody else, that actually studied this, giving people an opportunity to sample 24 jam flavors or 6 at a gourmet food store. And what they found is that more people came to the table when there were 24 jams than when there were 6, but only 1/10 as many people actually bought jam.
Really?
Yes. More people came, 1/10 as many people bought. And they showed the same thing with chocolates, and they showed in a third study with college students who were given topics for extra credit essays, and if you gave them 30 topics, they were less likely to write an essay than if you gave them 6 topics. So in several different domains, they found that when you give people a lot of choice, it ends up paralyzing them. And so now I had real data, not just my personal anecdote, about what can happen when people have too much choice. The woman who did that work, her name is Sheena Iyengar. She was a graduate student at the time at Stanford University, and this was her PhD thesis. And she's gone on to demonstrate this in lots and lots of different domains that are much more consequential than just buying a jar of jam. So that's what got me started thinking about this in a serious way. And it led a few years later. I mean, I did some research with some collaborators on an aspect of the choice problem. And then I wrote this book called The Paradox of Choice that tries, first of all, to lay out the phenomenon, what happens when people have too much choice, and then try to explain why. So that's my history.
So really the issue is that since we have so many choices, now we are determined to find the perfect thing rather than just the best thing.
My own research with my collaborators has focused on that very distinction. We developed a questionnaire, a scale, that tries to assess whether when people make decisions, they are out to get the best, as you just said, or out to get good enough. Mm-hmm. We call the first set of people maximizers, you know, the best jam, the best place to go to college, the best job, the best romantic partner, the best genes. We call the second set of people satisficers. Good enough is what they're after, and they may have high standards or not, but they're not looking for the best. And this matters a lot when there are many options, because if there are only two kinds of genes, it basically doesn't matter what you're after. You can try them both. But if there are 200 or 2,000 or 20,000 kinds of genes, well, if you're a maximizer, the only way to know you've got the best is by looking at every option, which is just not possible. So you drive yourself crazy for a while, and then you say, you know, I have to shave, I have to go to work, there's all this other stuff to do, I have to change the kid's diaper, enough, and you pick something. And you spend the rest of your life convinced that if you'd looked someplace else, you'd have done better. Satisficers don't have to look at every option, because all they're interested in is answering one question. Is this good enough? And as soon as they find something that's good enough, they choose it, and that's the end of the story. So we developed this questionnaire, and it turns out people differ in this regard. Some people are more inclined to want the best than others. And what we find is that people who are out for the best are less optimistic, less satisfied with life, less happy, and more depressed than people who are looking for good enough. And I think what you suggested, and we don't know this for sure, I think that living in a world of millions of options encourages you to be out to look for the best. I mean, why would God have given me 2,000 kinds of genes if it wasn't my job to find the best pair, right? But we don't know that that's true. It could be that, you know, these patterns get developed for other reasons. And once they're there, if you live in a world of bountiful choice, it can be devastatingly paralyzing and lead to dissatisfaction.
So why do we think this way? Because this is completely counterintuitive.
What is counterintuitive? That you can have too much choice?
Yes.
It is counterintuitive. It is. And I think the reason it's counterintuitive is that we've all drunk the Kool-Aid of sort of free market, individualist democratic societies, which say that the epitome of life is to give people choice. And the more choice people have, the better off they are. It seems so sensible because, look, if you're content choosing among two pairs of genes and there are 200, you can just ignore the rest. You know, it doesn't have to have any impact on you at all. And meanwhile, I am not happy with those two pairs, so I've got all these other options to choose from. So what economists say about this is adding an option makes somebody better off and makes nobody worse off. So why not just keep adding options? And doesn't that make sense to you?
We can blame this on marketing then, because I enjoy blaming things on marketing.
Well, I think it's deeper than just marketing, because I think it's, certainly marketers, their mission in life is to convince us that whatever we have isn't good enough. So we need to be looking for something else. But I don't think marketers are responsible for seeing the same attitude when people are deciding where to go to college or what job to take or even who to have a serious romantic relationship with. I think it's much more pervasive than just, goods. And I think it's the ideology of society rather than just advertising plays a major role in this. And I see it in the students I teach. Young people have this sense that anything is possible. And no matter how complicated the world is, no matter how many options, they basically just say, well, let me at them. Throw them at me. I can handle this. So we're giving them just the world they think they want, and they're wrong to want this world. It is completely screwing them up. It's paralyzing them. It's making them miserable. They have a hard time pulling the trigger on any major decisions. It is not doing them a favor.
Are there particular types of decisions that are more likely to suffer from too much choice, or is this kind of evenly spread out?
In theory, it's evenly spread out, and we've never found that this is more pronounced in one area of life than another. Most people's intuitions are that you'd have to be nuts to be out in pursuit of the best pair of jeans. But on the other hand, the best romantic partner, the best job, well, that's a different story. The best doctor, that's worth wringing your hands over. So the intuition is that for important decisions, be a maximizer. And the more choice you have, the more likely you are to be able to find the best thing. And for trivial decisions, just, you know, get over yourself, pull the trigger, and live with it. But I think actually what sometimes happens is that it's the trivial decisions that really hang people up. Because the big decisions, should I have children or not? How do you decide that? My God. If you're out to figure out what the best possible decision is, you'll be close to your grave before you figure out where to have. By the time you figure it out, the life will have figured it out for you. You know, so what I find often happens is that people who are really out always to make the best decision are so paralyzed by really big decisions that they just basically say the hell with it and they take a flyer. And these same people will spend 3 weeks looking for a sweater.
Well, and see, this is what I'm wondering. It seems like it's partially personality, but partially how closely we personally identify with our choices.
That's very perceptive of you.
Thank you.
And here's what I think. Here's one consequence, I think, of having so many choices. The question is, what's an important decision? Now, you might well agree that in the final analysis, in the grand scheme of things, it really doesn't matter much what you cover your body with, clothes or clothes, right? Mm-hmm. And if there are two kinds of jeans, then clothes are clothes. Because no matter what choice you make, you can't really use the clothes you wear to tell the world something about who you are. Because there's much more variation among people than there are different kinds of jeans. Mm-hmm. If there are 2,000 pairs of jeans or 20,000, well, now all of a sudden it's possible for your wardrobe decisions to paint you as a unique person so that you are showing something to the world about who you are in what you wear just because the world has made so much available. And what I think that does, is this making sense?
Yes, absolutely.
So what that means is that all of a sudden your clothing becomes a matter of personal identity. No less than what you study, what kind of work you do, what religion you pursue. It says to the world, this is who I am. And it couldn't say that when there were Levi's and Lee's. You know, there just wasn't enough out there for your choice of jeans to be making a statement about who you are. But now there is. And what that means is that the stakes go up, and so people wring their hands about even unimportant decisions like that.
But then there's the terribly unimportant decisions. Because honestly, I've been standing in the line at the supermarket and, you know, there will be the individual ahead of me who's taking 10 minutes to pick a pack of gum. So how does that fit in? Because seems like you cannot be that personally involved with your gum choice.
It's true, but you also don't want to be a fool. So, I mean, you know, my moment like that comes when I go to buy dental floss. Now, you probably couldn't imagine that you could come up with 40 different kinds of dental floss, but there are. And you say to yourself, I say to myself, damn it, if they go to the trouble to make them, one of them has to be right. Flat or not flat, flavored or not flavored, this thickness or that thickness. You know, so you look at all the dental flosses and you figure out which one is the right one for you. And you feel like a fool if you don't do it. Or your cell phone company gives you, 2,000 different phones to choose from and 25 different cell phone plans. If you close your eyes and just stick your finger on the page and take whatever plan your finger lands on, you feel like a jackass. Maybe you're paying too much money. So instead you scrutinize all the options, right? And it takes you 2 weeks. And by then all the plans have changed. So, you know, even if it's an unimportant, here's a really unimportant decision. You go shopping at the supermarket and you have a cart of groceries and the supermarket's crowded and you have to decide which checkout line to stand in. Now, I don't know if you've ever agonized about this, but here's what happens. You pick a line and then you spend all of your time looking at the other lines to see if they're moving faster than yours. And if they are, you kick yourself for having made a bad decision. You know, and, you know, we have this ability to remember those occasions when we pick the wrong line. So you walk around thinking, I'm so unlucky. I always pick the wrong checkout line in the supermarket. Now, what could be more trivial than choosing a checkout line? But people can beat themselves up because it took them 15 minutes to get checked out instead of 7 or 8. You can fix this. And this is a lesson. You can fix this by having only one checkout line. Doing it the way they do it in Disney World, you know, where there's this serpentine one line, and then as soon as a register opens, you go to that register. Then you have no decision to make. Instead of forcing you to just, you know, to make a bet on which checkout line is going to move the fastest.
So does that actually make people happier?
That would actually make people happier. And the challenge for psychology is to figure out how much. What kinds of constraints in the choices people make will actually make them happier, and what kinds of constraints will make them feel like they need to bust out because you're depriving them of the opportunity for self-development, for self-definition, and so on. And this is not an easy thing to figure out, because what to you seems trivial to someone else will seem important. So rather than answer this hard question, which is which choices matter and how many, we avoid that question by simply assuming just give people as much choice as possible, and that has to be more choice has to be better than less. So it's very challenging. My own sense is that there is a sweet spot. There's some amount of choice that enables us to feel and actually be free to live our lives the way we think we should live them. Less choice than that is unbearable. More choice than that is paralyzing. And the task is to figure out how much is just the right amount.
You can't tell us that, can you?
No, I mean, nobody has any idea. Listen, it hasn't occurred to anyone except maybe in the last 10 years that choice is a problem. This is all new research and new thinking. There's no research, for example, on how children learn to make choices. And the reason there's no research on how children learn to make choices is that it never occurred to anyone that this is a question that is worth answering. Evolution probably shaped us so that if there are two or three attractive things in our environments, we say yes to all of them. Because we may go 3 or 4 days before our next meal. You say yes to the squirrel and yes to the berries and yes to the, I don't know what, the lion. Who knows when your next meal is coming? Well, now you take your kid to the bank, and the bank teller, sweet person that he or she is, asks your child, would you like a lollipop? Do you call them lollipops in Texas, Canada?
I do.
You do? Okay.
Well, some people call them suckers, for reference.
Suckers. Mm-hmm. So would you like a red one or a green one or a yellow one? And your 4-year-old child thinks, deep in his or her evolutionary bones, I want all of them. Why can't I have all of them? What do you mean a red one or a green one or a yellow one? So how do kids learn to say no to things they want? This is not an easy thing to do. It's a very, very hard thing to do. And how do we teach them to do that? And it's, as I say, it's unstudied because it's not been problematic. People haven't realized that choices like this actually are problematic. So if you decide to give up what you do now and get a PhD in psychology, you can study how children learn how to make choices.
I've seen a YouTube video about children that were offered marshmallows.
Yes.
You know which one I'm talking about.
Oh, I do indeed.
Can you explain that?
Yes, this is slightly different. So this is about how children learn to control impulses. So the task is you can have one marshmallow now, or you can have two marshmallows in 10 minutes. Or you can play with this boring toy while I go out of the room, but if you wait, when I come back into the room, I'll give you a much more interesting toy. And then the experimenter leaves the room, and of course the kid is being videotaped, and the kid just can't keep his hands off the door. Yeah, and it's they torture themselves. You know, they look away, they sit on their hands, they do all kinds of stuff. But eventually, at least many of them succumb.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, they can't resist temptation. So this is really about self-control. How do we develop self-control? And the guy who did this work, Walter Mischel, interestingly, has found out that kids who are weak on this task at age four, knowing that can predict how well they're going to do in school 12 years later. This seems to be a deep characteristic of people, and it's one that casts a very long shadow. It's really basically about being able to discipline yourself and avoid temptations.
But isn't it also about choice?
Well, it is about choice, but it hasn't really been framed in that way because you only have two options. Choose one marshmallow now or two marshmallows later. Choose the boring toy now or the exciting toy later. So the problem really isn't that you can't decide. You've decided. You can't control yourself. You know you want two marshmallows later, but you can't resist the one marshmallow now. So that's a different problem. And that has been studied extensively.
So is there at any point that somebody cannot resist making a certain choice, even if they have multiples?
I think that often it is, and often it's about things that are especially attractive and are available immediately. If you defer the option just a few minutes, you know, one marshmallow in 5 minutes or two marshmallows in 20, now the kid has no problem. There's something about immediacy that's very, very hard to resist. And, you know, this is how adolescents get themselves into trouble with too much ingestion of illegal substances or sex without condoms. There's this, you know, you get aroused and there's this opportunity for instant gratification, and waiting even a minute is just unimaginable. So they don't. And so people are plagued by this all through life, some more than others. And there's some evidence that it's actually, it works kind of like a muscle, in that if I give you a series of things to do that require you to control yourself, control your impulses, the muscle gets tired. And by the time you get to the third or fourth thing, even though they're unrelated things, by the time you get to the third or fourth thing, you just can't resist.
Really?
You succumb to temptation. And that suggests, of course, that if you exercise that muscle, you get better at it. You can build up your self-control muscle by exercising it.
How much do you think that we can utilize self-control to affect our choices then?
I think it's critical because, you know, so my research suggests that you don't want to be a maximizer. You want to learn that good enough is good enough. So you read my book and I offer this convincing evidence that good enough is good enough. And then you decide, well, starting tomorrow, that's going to be how I make my decisions. Except that tomorrow comes, and you don't just snap your fingers and give up on wanting the best. So it takes an enormous amount of self-control to suppress the temptation to go to one more store, look at one more website. And that, now, let me just say that with shopping online, the temptation is overwhelming because you don't have to get in the car and drive across town. You just have to click. So how many websites is enough websites to look at? This has happened any number of times. My wife or I will go online to buy some $20 item, and one of us will say to the other one, I'll be down in 10 minutes. 3 hours later, we're still there.
Oh.
And it's because, you know, why not look at just one more website? And before you know it, you've wasted an obscene amount of time on something completely unimportant.
You've just described my entire life.
Well, it's everybody's entire life. And because you're not making a decision at the start, you're not saying, well, should I spend 4 hours buying a $20 toaster or not? Instead, what you're saying is, should I spend another 20 seconds? And the answer to that is always yes.
But
why not another 20 seconds?
But we're raised in a culture that's taught us that you can find that perfect thing, those perfect jeans or the perfect couch or the perfect home furnishings. It's about how much work you're putting in.
Yep.
If you just put in the work.
It's a lie. You can't. You can't. Life is all about trade-offs. There is no couch that is in every way the best. You'll like one couch because of its color. You'll like another one because of its comfort. You'll like another one because of its price. And you will say, God, why didn't they make a couch that is that color and that comfort and that price? Why do they force me to make trade-offs? Well, that's just the way life is. So the pursuit of the perfect is a fool's errand. And it's particularly a fool's errand because once you're in the part of the distribution of, say, high quality, they're all about equal. We have this problem now with college admissions. Swarthmore is a very selective school. We admit each class we have about 350 kids, a small school, and we get 5,500 applications. Probably half, maybe more, of the applications are students who would do fine. So of 5,500 applications, let's say 3,000 would do fine as students. We have to find from that 3,000, 300. Let me assure you that you can't make the kinds of distinctions we try to make when you're operating in an area of the distribution where all of these candidates are essentially equivalent to each other. But we torture ourselves trying to find the very best from a large set of people, all of whom are excellent. And that's what happens when you're trying to, you know, find a couch. These are all great couches. Which one is the greatest? It's a fool's errand, and people can torture themselves indefinitely, wasting time. And worse than that, they finally choose a couch, or we finally choose a student, and we're convinced that we could have made a better choice.
So
you don't even get satisfaction out of your decision that you should.
This is not just about, if I work hard enough, I'll make the right choice. This is also about, if I'm smart enough, I'll make the right choice.
Right, but you're setting yourself an impossible task because there is no right choice. What's the best place to go on vacation? What does that even mean? You're trying to decide where to go this summer on vacation. You want to go to the best place. What's the best place? What's the best place to go to school? What's the best job? There's no answer to these questions. But if you think that that's the question you have to answer, then you'll split hairs to make distinctions among things that are essentially equivalent and be convinced when the dust, and as soon as one thing goes wrong, you know, you go someplace, the best place on vacation, and it rains one day, and you're convinced that you made a bad decision. If you'd been smarter or more disciplined, put in more work, you'd have found a place where it never rains. That Death Valley.
Are you saying that no matter what choice we make about anything, we're doomed to regret it?
No. I think the more of a, we have another scale that measures regret. The more of a maximizer you are, the more likely it is you'll regret your choices, whatever they are. If you're looking for good enough, then you'll only regret mistakes. I thought this was good enough. It wasn't. My bad. Silly me. But if you're looking for the best, even a good outcome is, you can find a reason, way to regret even a good outcome because maybe it's not the best outcome. So I think that maximizers really are extreme candidates for regret. And in fact, I think it is the pain of regret that explains why people faced with lots of options choose none. Because the only way to make sure you won't regret your decision is by not making it. And that's the often the worst decision of all. I'll just give you one example of that. The U.S. has 401k retirement plans. A lot of employers offer them. The employee puts some money in. The employer matches the contribution. It's voluntary. It's not mandatory. And some companies will offer their employees 5 different mutual funds that they can invest in. Some will offer 10. Some will offer 20. Some will offer 50. And some will offer hundreds. And the same woman I mentioned to you before, Sheena Iyengar, studied real people making real decisions in many different companies and found the more mutual funds the company offered, the less likely employees were to choose any. And this is very consequential because by not choosing, they were passing up matching money from the employer. They were in effect lighting a match to a check for $5,000 because they couldn't figure out which choice was the right choice. It's a disaster.
This is a very depressing conversation. Barry.
there's hope. I mean,
good. Give us the hope. Give us the hope.
So, all right. So one thing is that it is really worth the effort to teach yourself to be satisfied with good enough. And everybody is satisfied with good enough in some areas of life. And the trick is just to extend that. There are very few people who want the best postage stamp. Mm-hmm. They just want a stamp that will get the mail to wherever it needs to go, right? So we know how to settle for good enough. And if we extend this strategy we already have to other areas of life, we will be less agonized making decisions. It will take us less time to make decisions, and we'll be more satisfied with the results. So that's one thing. Second is choose when to choose. Take advantage of the fact that you have friends who may have made similar decisions. When you're buying a digital camera, don't torture yourself. Call your friend and say, what camera do you have? Do you like it? And then just buy it. You know, not, you don't do that with respect to everything, but you do that with respect to some things. So you can reduce the number of decisions you face every day that are traps for, you know, paralysis and regret by, essentially letting other people make decisions for you.
So how does one do that in the society that we currently have? Because I could see if you started with a completely different process when you're young, teaching people to do this. But the idea of lowering your expectations when you already know that you could have higher expectations, how does one do that?
Well, you need to have the experience of having higher expectations and ending up doing better and feeling worse. And if that, so what people who've gotten in touch with me, who read my book, I mean, God knows how many people read my book and thought it was a crock. But, you know, the people who thought it wasn't a crock, what they have to say is, you know, I thought that was something about me. I couldn't make decisions, or I would make decisions and I would be kicking myself for the decisions I made. And you helped me see that this is a problem that is widely shared. And that made me feel less strange, less pathological, and more empowered to change the way I make decisions. And, you know, do they actually do it in a way that's consistent and systematic, and does it make their lives better? That I don't know, but that's what they tell me. It was like a light bulb went on. They stopped obsessing about things. They decided good enough was good enough. Decisions that would take them weeks, they were able to make in a day. And they suffered not one bit. In fact, they felt even better about the decisions than they had previously when they you know, were painstakingly trying to make the best decision. So that suggests that this is something that, you know, you can fix this by paying attention to it. What you can't do is expect there to be, like the government to step in and say, from now on, there are only going to be 10 kinds of cereal in the supermarket. That's not going to happen. So I'm afraid it's on us to find ways essentially to reduce the effective amount of choice we have, since the world isn't going to do it for us. But I think that, you know, people can do it.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, it's a pre-recorded hour on the intersection between science and the creative arts. We'll speak to Lauren Redness, author and illustrator of Radioactive, a visual narrative about the work, life, and love of Marie and Pierre Curie. Visual historian Jenna Marie Griffith explains the historical influence of science on the arts. And we're joined by Glendon Mello, painter, illustrator, and author of the blog The Flying Trilobite, to discuss the tension between creativity and scientific accuracy. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 Mountain Time, live at skepticallyspeaking.com.
So you think, though, that the, I guess I'd have to call it massive and widespread angst in our society is directly connected to this?
Yeah, I don't want to be sort of an egomaniac about this. I think there's more than one thing going on, but I think this is one of the things that's going on that has a lot to do with the angst that people feel. There's a cartoon at the end of my book that I took from the New Yorker with a parent fish and a baby fish in a little tiny fish bowl, and they're swimming around, and the caption reads, "You can be anything you want to be, no limits." Now here we are looking at this fish bowl, which is, you know, roughly the size of a glass. And we sophisticated urbanites look at it and say, what do these idiots know? How myopic can you be? There's nothing going on in that fishbowl. They don't know what they, you know, they could be living in New York, for God's sakes. And, you know, so that your first reaction is that it makes, you know, what an idiot, what a fool the parent is. But as I looked at it and thought about it some more, what I came to realize is that you need a fishbowl. We all need a fishbowl. If you shatter the fishbowl, life becomes scary. Decisions become impossible. People are full of angst. What we don't know is what needs to be inside the fishbowl and what the fishbowl needs to rule out. That's worth figuring out. I think that the reason young people are so full of angst is that we have shattered their fishbowl. We tell them you can do anything, you can be anything. Figure out what you want, who you want to be, what you want to do, and we'll make it possible. That's more freedom than they can handle. On the other hand, telling them you have to do exactly what your parents did is unacceptable. So what freedom is the right amount of freedom so that people fully benefit from being able to live their own lives without being completely paralyzed by all the freedom that entails? And as I say, I don't know the answer to that, neither does anyone else, and it's only in the last few years that people have realized that it's actually a problem that needs to be answered. So that's my sense of the role that too much choice plays in creating this angst. It's not the only thing going on, but I think there may be a piece of this choice, celebration of choice, involved in a lot. The economic uncertainty that people face is partly, in my view, because we worship at the altar of choice and we are not willing to restrict options, even if it means and provide people with more security.
So how does this apply to relationships? Relationships are definitely a choice.
Yes. And now we're entering mostly the world of speculation, but rather than actual data that have been collected. But it seems to me that you meet someone and you're interested in that person and that person is interested in you. And the question that you ask is this the best I can do when there are all those alternatives out there? And you ask that question even if you're really pretty content with who you have and who you're with. So you're together with your special someone, and each of you is looking over the other one's shoulder just in case something better comes by. This is not a recipe for a long-term romantic relationships, as far as I know. And I think that everyone, this unwillingness to commit is partly because there's the sense that there might be something better. You know, it's not, I don't want to commit because my parents got divorced and my aunt and uncle everybody I know got divorced, so I want to make sure I'm right. There's some of that. But I think it's also that you don't want to pass up a better opportunity. So you keep your options open indefinitely. And, you know, even if you're in a serious relationship, if your attitude is that your options are open, then it's not going to be a serious relationship that sustains itself. So I think people in good relationships break up because they're not as good as people expect their relationships to be, or not as good as they think the relationship would be if they started to see that other person instead. This is not a recipe for stable, long-term romance, in my mind.
Again, is this about finding, you know, the best within the realm that you can find, or is this about finding perfect?
Well, this is not how do you make that distinction exactly between what's the realm within which I can find nowadays with all of these internet social networks? The world is available to me. Isn't that right?
Yeah, and that's what I'm thinking. Your choices are practically unlimited.
Unlimited. You know, there are so many people lying about themselves online that, you know, it could take you your whole life to go through all these lies. So the best available to me and the best, period, are the same, because everything's available to me. And of course, since each of us thinks we're incredibly good looking in comparison to everybody else, in addition to being funny, sensitive, warm, and kind, who wouldn't want us as a partner? Isn't that right? So, yeah, I don't know what the data are. I'm sure there's a lot of research actually being done on these dating sites and stuff to see whether whatever filters they use to match people up are better than random. But if there isn't any out yet, there will be surely within the next 5 years or so. So many millions of people are using them. It's a gold mine for research. I would be surprised if this improved the quality of people's intimate relations.
Well, do you think there are different choice pressures for men than there are from women?
Well, you know, the biological story is that women trade sex for intimacy and men trade intimacy for sex. Mm-hmm. So this is based on the sort of what's called sexual dimorphism. The reproductive systems of men and women are different. The investment, women make a big investment in each potential offspring because they have to carry them. And they only have so many eggs that can be fertilized, you know. So a very productive woman can only produce, 20 or 30 kids in a lifetime?
Only.
Well, I know it's like a lot, but, you know, men can produce millions of kids. So any particular coupling for a man is less consequential than it is for a woman. And if, you know, if there's a little voice whispering to you, reproduce, 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 nothing else really matters. Men are going to be promiscuous. And if the only way I can get you into bed with me is by promising you that I will listen to your sob stories and care about you and pat your hand. So I'll be intimate with you if you'll have sex with me. That's the deal that I make. And you, on the other hand, don't care much about sex. You just want intimacy because you want somebody to be around and protect your kid and provide for your kid. So you say, okay, I'll have sex with you if you promise to stay around. And each of you makes this promise, meaning it. And then, of course, lo and behold, you know, the man, you get pregnant, you have the kid, and the man goes off looking for another potential mother for the next round of children. So that's a story that comes out of evolutionary biology that
right.
suggests the choice problem is different for men and women. Women are choosy. Men are completely indiscriminate.
But the times have changed since.
Well, look, I think this biological story is way too reductive.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's completely irrelevant, but the times have changed and we have the ability to control these impulses, even if we feel them. We don't have to act on them. And I think there's good reason to think that men have grown increasingly to care about intimacy. And women have grown to care more about sex. But I still don't think that there's anything close to parity between men and women, at least not in any society I know about, as far as that goes. So I think that women are the choosers when it comes to romantic relationships, for the most part, still.
Well, the idea of choosing to be in a relationship, to be married, is still quite recent. Because it seems according to your theory, it seems like an arranged marriage would be much happier.
Right. Well, it might. And there's interesting evidence that arranged marriages work. Over time, the couple, people have the wrong idea about arranged marriages. It's not literally that the parents say, okay, you marry him. And that's that. You know, you give the woman gets a menu to choose from. The parents choose the menu. So there is choice involved, but choice from a limited set of candidates, as I understand it. And you know, people find happiness in arranged marriages. The way I see the change, though, at least in the West, in the U.S., again, especially, is that a generation or two ago, the answer to the question, should I get married, was known. Virtually everybody had the same answer to that question, so it wasn't even a question. The answer was yes. The answer to the question, when, was as soon as possible. And should I have children? Yes. When? As soon as possible. So there was really only one question, and that was who, which is not easy, an easy question to answer. But all the other stuff was in place. Slowly but surely, over the last two generations, all of those questions with obvious answers have become questions with non-obvious answers. You don't have to get married. You don't have to get married now. You don't have to have children. You don't have to have children now. All of that stuff is up for grabs. All of that stuff is for you to figure out. So we have massively increased the amount of choice that is available and acceptable to people when it comes to intimate life. You know, the social norms about how one arranges intimate life have really changed dramatically. At least they have on the coasts. My guess is that in the middle of the U.S., it's more traditional. It's closer to the traditional past than it is in, you know, New York and California and Pennsylvania and Washington and Vancouver. That's my guess. But there's no question that at least in the coastal areas in North America, everything's up for grabs. Everything's a matter of choice. And the result, of course, is that you can beat yourself up about every aspect of that decision. I got married late. I should have gotten married early. I decided not to have children. I should have had children. I decided to have children late. I should have had children right first thing. So for every aspect of this part of your life that involves a decision, it's an opportunity for you to regret whatever decision you made.
And back to the depressing. So is there a particular area of our lives that we should be most trying to limit our choices or lower our expectations?
I think that we should be trying to lower our expectations pretty much across the board. I think that, and here I think marketing bears a lot of the burden. We have absurdly high expectations about everything. We expect perfection. What we get is good, but it's not perfect. And if it's not perfect, we feel like we failed or we've made a bad decision. So I think I have said sometimes people don't like this, that the secret to happiness is to have low expectations. Now that's an overstatement. So the secret to happiness is to have realistic expectations. And realistic expectations mean that none of your decisions will be perfect, that many things you do you will adapt to so that the excitement they provide at the beginning will wear off. Your new car will quickly just be your car. The unbelievable passion you have for your romantic partner will just become ordinary passion, and then physical attraction, and then occasional physical attraction, and then sort of thinking about a movie star while you're having sex with her. You know, you can minimize this process. You can slow it down. If you're aware that it's going to happen, I think it's not quite so painful when it does happen. It's only if you think, a la Hollywood, that you're going to be, you know, starry-eyed every time you look at each other for the next 60 years that you have an opportunity to be disappointed by what actually happens. So we create expectations about how that part of our life is supposed to go, and it doesn't go that way because it can't go that way, and we feel disappointed and also that we failed. So I think people suffer much more from having expectations that are too high than from having expectations that are too low.
So that's what you would leave people with, expectations.
The one thing is good enough is good enough, and the second thing is lower your expectations. You think that's depressing? It's a recipe for happiness, for God's sakes. It's easier to be happy than we think. You don't need the best to be happy. You just need good enough to be happy. I just took the pressure off you. You don't need to look at 2,000 pairs of jeans anymore.
and for that, we thank you.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Thanks so much, Barry, for being on Skeptically Speaking.
It really was. You asked fabulous questions. It was a pleasure.
To find all of Barry's books, including The Paradox of Choice, Why More is Less, click the link on this episode's show notes on our website, and that's at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, click the links to our Facebook page, to Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can download past episodes or subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking. Online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams. The charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus. Eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor. Leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier. Reading in between the lines of these lies, bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree.
gray shell, gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.